Hey y'all, check out shapeandfoster.com. Shape and Foster is a lifestyle development app that provides monthly actionable insight from six experts in mental health, financial planning, nutrition, fitness, yoga, and a life coach. It's a one-stop shop for self-improvement. The app provides a proactive and informed approach to improving your mental well-being by enabling practices and habits to be built. Lifestyle development is about enhancing your quality of life by improving awareness, identity, and potential. One community of actionable insight. Learn from six pillars essential to a healthy heart and healthy mind in one unique app. Visit www.shapeandfoster.com for your free 14-day trial. Links are in the show notes.
Hey fellow Okies and all true crime enthusiasts out there, I'm Cece, the host, writer, and producer of this, the Sooner State True Crime Podcast. Welcome y'all to Season 2, Episode 10 of the show, The Good Samaritan Murders. I apologize for being a day late, but in case you didn't listen to the announcement, my grandmother died this past week, and I just had to put off the podcast for a few days, but it's here now. In February of 2003, an almost divorced and somewhat lonely Tulsa, Oklahoma woman connected online with a deadly date. This online Casanova turned out to be a serial killer that needlessly took three lives because his sexual advances were not reciprocated. Thanks y'all so much to everyone out there for listening to the podcast. It's been a little over a year since I started, and I'm still surprised that anyone out there likes the show, but I'm grateful. Thanks, y'all. And I'm sure you guys will understand that I need to take a break from posting new episodes for a bit. So this will be the last new episode until February 15th, 2021. I'll be spending my break researching upcoming cases and working on bringing y'all even better content and storytelling for the new season. I'll be going much more in depth with certain cases, and hopefully interviewing some of those directly involved with some cases. But that costs money, so now more than ever, we need your support. Please donate anything you can spare at paypal.me/crimestate. Any donation over $5 will receive SSTC stickers and a shout out. Please donate anything y'all can spare. Thank you. Also, be sure y'all subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or whichever app you prefer. And leave us a 5-star review while you're there. It helps us out. Follow our social media on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at OK Crime State for updates, and check out the website, crimestatepod.com, for all the sources and everything SSTC. Feel free to email me your comments or any cases you'd like me to cover. Remember, it doesn't have to occur in Oklahoma. It could be an Okie criminal, or the victim could be from Oklahoma too. So email me at soonerstatecrimepod@gmail.com. Now, let's get into our case for this episode, The Good Samaritan Murders. In Tulsa, Oklahoma, on an early February morning, a man driving home noticed flames coming from a house. He stopped and called 911. But he had stumbled upon more than a simple house fire, and it would cost him his life. Inside the burning home, there were two murder victims. So come away with me to the wee hours of February 23rd, 2003, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where the following crimes occurred. Kenneth Dwayne Maxwell was born on November 14, 1978, in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He was the youngest of five kids and had a twin sister. His mother, Shirley Maxwell, described her son as a, quote, wonderful young man, who was always willing to lend a helping hand to his family and strangers alike. Kenneth graduated from Central High School in Tulsa and taught himself how to play guitar during school. He also played multiple other instruments as well. Kenneth was just 24 years old when this tragedy occurred. He was working as a truck driver and lived just a mile away from Fred and Rebecca Barney. He was engaged to the love of his life and loved music as well. Kenneth had a passion for medieval reenactments and planned to study structural engineering in college. In the early morning hours of February 23, 2003, Kenneth was driving home from a party when he noticed the flames starting to engulf the Barney's home. Freddie Leon Barney was born on April 12, 1952, in Vinita, Oklahoma. Fred was a lifelong Okie and was also a longtime employee at Morrow Mechanical Heating and Air. Rebecca Susan Robinson Barney was born on September 17, 1960, in Buffalo, New York. She worked as a nail technician. The couple were married in 1996. The Barneys didn't have any children and lived together in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Unfortunately, in 2003, after 6 years of marriage, the Barneys decided to file for divorce. Despite their split, Fred and Rebecca were still friends, and the divorce was completely amicable. Therefore, the couple decided to continue living in their house together and sleep separately until the divorce was finalized. The arrangement was somewhat unusual, but it seemed to work for the Barneys. James Jimmy Lynn Kidwell was born on December 10, 1971. He was married and had two children before the Kidwells divorced. After the split, Kidwell was experiencing money issues and had to move back home with his mother in Gore, Oklahoma, which is about 120 miles east of Oklahoma City. In early 2003, Kidwell was 31 years old and a part-time computer science student. The year before the murders, Kidwell was questioned but never charged in a domestic violence case. Kidwell slashed the tires of an ex-girlfriend, which should have served as a red flag. Kidwell used the internet and dating websites to meet women online, with the goal of ultimately meeting these women in person to have sex. Just 3 days before the murders, Kidwell met Rebecca Barney online, a meeting that would prove deadly not only for Rebecca, but her ex-husband and an innocent bystander. On the evening of February 22, 2003, soon-to-be-divorced but still friendly couple Fred and Rebecca Barney arrived at their usual spot, Arnie's Bar in Tulsa, Oklahoma. They were accompanied by a very tall man that no one recognized. Witnesses recalled Rebecca, or Becky as her friends called her, introduced the man as her new internet boyfriend, Cowboy. They also recalled that Fred seemed uninterested and tired as he sat with his soon-to-be ex-wife and her new apparent beau. He also told some people at the bar that he disliked this cowboy character. Fellow bar patrons also recalled Becky referred to the strange man as her, quote, 10-inch cowboy, but they never heard a real name. Witnesses said the trio left the bar at closing time together, which is 2 a.m., and that they went back to the Barney's home, which was only 5 minutes away from the bar. Tulsa 911 dispatchers receive approximately 3,000 calls a night. One of those calls came into 911 at 3:17 a.m. on February 23, 2003, about a house fire. The caller was a 24-year-old young man who happened to drive by and see flames named Kenneth Maxwell. Quote, "I can see flames, but I can't really see smoke. I mean, the back of the house is lit up," Maxwell stated. 911 dispatcher said, quote, "And what's your name?" Maxwell said, quote, "My name's Kenneth Maxwell." 911 said, quote, "Kenneth, where are you calling from?" Kenneth replied, quote, "Cell phone. I was on my way home from my friend's house." 911 told Maxwell to stay at the scene until the firefighters arrived. Then it appeared like an interaction occurs between Maxwell and someone who walks up. Kenneth is heard saying, quote, "Is there a fire in there? Huh? Okay." The 911 operator then says, quote, "Hello, hello," but hears no answer. The call then disconnects. Firefighters arrive shortly after to the house located at 502 South Yorktown Avenue in Tulsa. They were able to successfully extinguish the flames just in time. Had the firemen arrived just 10 minutes later, the Barney's home would have been a total loss and all evidence destroyed. The firemen also located a car in front of the home, with a slumped over man sitting inside, with a gunshot wound. He was pronounced dead at the scene. Later, the man was identified as the 911 caller, Kenneth Maxwell. Inside the home, firefighters located two bodies. First, a man was discovered in the kitchen with a gunshot wound to the back of his head. He was shot at point-blank range. He had been covered up with a rug. The second body was that of a female, located in a back bedroom. The woman was nude and had been shot 3 times in the head. The killer used a pillow to shoot through in an attempt to silence the gunshots. The victims inside the home were identified as the homeowners, 51-year-old Fred Barney and 42-year-old Rebecca Barney. In the living room, police found Rebecca's clothing folded in 2 neat piles. Her glasses were placed on top of her folded shirt, which indicated to investigators that was not done voluntarily. Arson investigators determined that the fire was intentionally set. The stove was pulled out from the wall, and the gas line was cut to try and cover up the murders with the fire. Evidence suggested that Fred was surprised by the killer, because he was in his pajamas, apparently making a sandwich, when he was shot in the back of his head. There was also no signs of a struggle, and no signs of forced entry either. Due to the fact Rebecca had been shot 3 times, police identified her as the main target of the attack. The killer was obviously angry with Rebecca. The fact there was no signs of forced entry into the home made police surmise that either both or one of the Barneys knew the killer. In addition, nothing seemed to be missing from the home, which ruled out robbery as a motive. The victim's money, credit cards, jewelry, and other items of value were untouched. That is, until investigators noticed that the back computer tower was missing from a bedroom. This told police the crime certainly had an internet or computer angle to it. The investigation into the murders of Fred and Rebecca Barney and the murder of Kenneth Maxwell not only required old-school police work to be solved, but it needed help from computer science. Ballistics proved that all 3 victims were shot with the same .22-caliber gun. Investigators couldn't find any connection between the Barneys and Maxwell, which indicated that he was just an innocent victim who was just trying to help. A forward-thinking paramedic at the original murder scene took swabs from Rebecca's neck and breast for possible DNA evidence. Next to the missing computer tower in the Barney home, investigators found the printout of a dating profile belonging to a James Kidwell, as well as emails Becky printed from a man with the screen name Cowboy4U67. The emails were sexual in nature, and the pair exchanged pictures as well. Rebecca's pictures were more modest than Cowboy4U's, who sent a picture of his penis with a ruler next to it. Throughout the emails, police noticed that Rebecca was a lonely, sort of lost soul that tried hard to please the men she emailed with. In his picture, Cowboy4U67 was wearing sunglasses, so they could only identify his screen name. This led Tulsa PD investigators to seek help from the Cyber Crimes Unit. A court-authorized search revealed the individual using the Cowboy4U screen name had just met someone new online 3 days before the murders, using the screen name Wild Ivy. The person that used the Wild Ivy screen name was Rebecca Barney, and Cowboy For You was identified as James Kidwell. The identification of Kidwell was completed by a group of University of Tulsa students, the TU Cyber Corps. Quote, TU students helped gather electronic evidence and ID'd the murderer, Professor Chenoy, head of TU Cyber Corps, explained. Kidwell was 31 years old, living with his mother in Gore, Oklahoma, which is about a 90-minute drive from Tulsa. He was a part-time computer science student with money troubles. He did not have any criminal record, but at the time of the murders, he was wanted in neighboring Haskell County, Oklahoma, for assaulting a woman at knife point in October of 2002. He was also named in a 2001 assault case, but was never charged. When Tulsa authorities notified law enforcement in Gore of their intentions to come arrest Kidwell, they got a nice surprise. While Tulsa police were on their way to serve their warrant, Gore Police Officer Joe Garrett, who'd been notified of Kidwell's warrants, received information from a Gore apartment manager that saw Kidwell exit a vehicle with a gun and then saw him drive off with a woman in a red pickup. Garrett arrested the pair in a restaurant parking lot. After Kidwell was arrested by Gore PD, they noticed his car was a total mess. Kidwell signed a waiver allowing for the search of his vehicle, though. During the car search, police found a rifle in his car, which was a weapons violation. When Gore PD arrested Kidwell, he said he, quote, figured it had something to do with what happened in Tulsa, Tulsa Detective Colburn said later. Upon his arrest, Kidwell was in the company of another young woman he'd met online less than 12 hours after the murders. When questioned by police, the woman immediately regretted dating Kidwell. She told police that he always carried a loaded weapon on him, and that she was scared that he'd invaded her life. Upon his arrest, the home of Kidwell's mother, where he was living, was searched for evidence. Although the murder weapon was not found, nor the missing Barney computer, the hard drive of Kidwell's own computer was taken into evidence. Small caliber ammunition was located as well. The first detectives to interview Kidwell about the murders was Tulsa Detective Stephen Colburn and Roger Smith. In his police interview, Kidwell even asked police what had happened to Becky since he didn't read newspapers or watch any TV. Despite Kidwell's initial claims he didn't know Rebecca Barney, searches of his computer proved his keen interest in the murders. Someone on his computer kept looking up news stories with the latest information about the murders. Kidwell's hard drive also showed numerous contacts with many women online, but only one deleted series of files that contained Rebecca Barney's screen name was found. Investigators were able to see that Kidwell and Rebecca met just 3 days before the murders, and that they exchanged over 70 emails on the day before the murders alone. Rebecca gave Kidwell her phone number, and after the murders, all communication stopped. The case really broke open when Kidwell's computer contained information that linked him to one of the victims, Rebecca Barney. The University of Tulsa Cyber Corps student worked alongside Tulsa PD detectives to extract critical emails and instant messages between Barney and Kidwell from his hard drive. Kidwell had also placed Rebecca on a block list on the dating site where they met, right after the murders. Once confronted with the cyber evidence in this case, Kidwell began to change his story. He finally admitted knowing Rebecca Barney and admitted to wanting a sexual encounter the night they met, but that Fred being there made it clear to Kidwell that sex wasn't on the menu. He did admit to being at the bar with the Barneys that night, but claimed he only stayed 5 to 10 minutes before leaving and driving the 90 minutes back to Gore. Investigators also found blood at Kidwell's house and on the gear shift knob of his vehicle that matched Rebecca Barney. In Kidwell's dryer, police found two shirts that were washed but still contained blood-colored stains. Despite being washed and dried, analysis were able to obtain a DNA profile. That profile could not exclude Rebecca Barney from being a contributor, but only 1 in 12,000 people in the general population could match the profile. The rape kit collected on Rebecca Barney contained the killer's DNA, but it was difficult to isolate. The fact Miss Barney was on her menstrual cycle at the time of her murder made her DNA basically overwhelm the sample. Therefore, scientists use a process called Y-STR, which zeroes in on the Y chromosome, since only men have it. The sample was small, but fortunately, a DNA profile was created, and it matched Kidwell. On March 13, 2003, three first-degree murder charges against James Kidwell were filed in Tulsa County. The affidavit alleged that DNA from Kidwell matched the DNA found on Becky's body. Police believe that the night of the murders, Kidwell was expecting a torrid sexual encounter with Becky Barney, which is why he drove the 75 miles. It wasn't just to say hi. As a precaution, Rebecca asked Fred to come along with her to meet this cowboy for you. Despite just returning from a business trip, Fred reluctantly goes with Becky. After they meet and hang out a while at the bar, the trio leaves together and headed for the Barney's house just 5 minutes away. Fred most likely went to his room and got ready for bed. In the next room, Becky must have turned down Kidwell's sexual advances, and he left the residence angry. Kidwell went to his car, got his .22 caliber gun, and re-entered the Barney home, but this time, he was armed. He shoots and kills Fred, sexually assaulted and raped Rebecca, before shooting her 3 times in the head. Kidwell cut the stove's gas line in order to start a fire and flees the home. However, Kidwell didn't plan on a Good Samaritan seeing the flames and calling police. This good deed cost him his life. The three first-degree murder charges were filed against James Kidwell in Tulsa County Court on March 13, 2003. The affidavit filed by police stated Kidwell met Mrs. Barney online, and then they met in person at a Tulsa bar, before going back to the Barney home. Kidwell admitted to leaving the house, but then returned and murdered Fred, and then raped and killed Becky. The affidavit alleged that DNA found on Rebecca Barney's body was a match to the DNA of James Kidwell. The murder trial began in the fall of 2004 in Tulsa County and was presided over by District Judge Jesse Harris. The state's case was being argued by First Assistant DA Doug Drummond, and Kidwell was represented by a public defender named Pete Silva. Throughout the trial, the jury would hear from 36 prosecution witnesses, be presented with over 100 court exhibits in a circumstantial case. James Kidwell would not testify in his own defense, but the jury did hear from Kidwell's fellow inmate, Jack Harris. Harris, a jailhouse informant, testified that Kidwell told him he was concerned about the additional voice heard on the 911 call. Harris testified that Kidwell worried the FBI had the technology to create a voice print from the 911 call. The state also showed the jury evidence that Kidwell attempted to destroy the murder scene and any evidence by cutting the gas line to the Barney stove. Then, he left the house and shot and killed Kenneth Maxwell before fleeing back to his mom's house in Gore. The prosecution stated this was the most serious crime that was started online. Kidwell's defense attorney, Pete Silva, argued to the jury that his client did, in fact, have a sexual encounter with Rebecca Barney, but that he left her alive. That was the explanation for his saliva and semen being found on Becky's body. Closing arguments in the case lasted 6 full hours before the jury was sent to deliberate the fate of Kidwell. After 7 hours of deliberations, the jury told Judge Harris that they could not reach a unanimous verdict. There were indications of a 9-3 split, but majority for guilty. The judge then instructed the jury to continue to deliberate, which they did until 3:20 a.m., when the judge called them back to court. The jurors told Judge Harris that they were not completely hopelessly deadlocked, and that some rest and a recess would be beneficial in reaching a verdict. So the jurors were shuttled to a hotel. 10 hours later, they were escorted back to the courthouse and back into the deliberation room at 2 p.m. 3 hours later, they had a verdict, guilty on all 3 charges, on December 2, 2004. Kidwell's family cried as the verdict was read, but the victims' families were relieved. Quote, "I'm elated. Justice was done, as far as I'm concerned," Becky's mother, Diane Beaver, said. Kenneth's mother, Shirley Maxwell, stated, quote, "I am so thankful to God for this." Kidwell maintained his composure after hearing his fate and being handcuffed in court. On December 15, 2004, Kidwell was sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole on all 3 counts. Becky's brother, Bill Robinson, said this case illustrates that, quote, "women need to be very careful with internet dating." On February 26, 2007, Kidwell appealed his conviction to the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals. The OCCA issued an unpublished opinion that affirmed Kidwell's 3 convictions. On May 20, 2008, Kidwell filed his first application for state post-conviction relief, which the OCCA also denied. Kidwell filed a second application for post-conviction relief on July 9, 2009, and was again denied. So on April 13, 2010, Kidwell filed a pro se petition for a writ of habeas corpus in U.S. District Court for Northern District of Oklahoma. This was also unsuccessful. James Kidwell will die in an Oklahoma prison. Thanks, y'all, so much for listening to Season 2, Episode 10, The Good Samaritan Murders of Sooner State True Crime. Our next new episode won't be released until February 15th, 2021, while I take my winter break. But don't worry, I'll be back with more crime stories that only happen in Oklahoma. Be sure y'all are subscribed to the podcast in Apple, Spotify, or whichever app you prefer, so you never miss a new episode. And while you're there, please leave us a 5-star review. It really helps. And to ensure the upcoming new season is the best it can be, we need your support financially. So please visit paypal.me/crimestate to donate any amount. Donations over $5 will receive SSTC stickers and a shout out. So please donate today. Also, follow our social media on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at OKCrimeState. And the sources for this and every episode are listed on our website, crimestatepod.com. I'd love to hear what cases y'all want me to cover on the podcast, so email me at soonerstatecrimepod@gmail.com. This last year of creating this show has been so amazing. I've learned so much about podcasting, of course, but also about myself, and I actually liked what I learned. So thanks, y'all, for going on this journey with me. And please tell your family and friends to listen too. Thanks, y'all, and much love. I'll be back with you on February 15th. But until then, every one of you loyal listeners out there, please stay sooner safe out there, y'all. Be back in a month.